So I've passed out a couple of sheets that just basically have three quotes that are some of the places that I'm anchored in this talk. I didn't expect there to be so many of us here, so that's my failure of imagination. So just share with each other, and if you don't have one, it's fine. The first one comes from an Asian Dub Foundation song that really we should have just been playing that quotes Asada Shakur, and one of the parts of it says, "The only way to live on this planet with any human dignity at the moment is to struggle." In the rest of the song, some of what it says is, "I'm a reluctant warrior, I'm a reluctant struggler. I wish I had been born into a time where it was not necessary to struggle." So one of the things that this little piece that I'm going to share with you is trying to think about is what it looks like to try to imagine a world and create that world in our action in which it's not necessary to struggle the way it is necessary to struggle now in order to access any human dignity. So Alex mentioned that this is coming out of a book that I'm finishing, which is called Against Purity, Living in Compromised Times. And I'm trying in this book to think about what it looks like to not assume that what we should be aiming for is personal, individual, moral purity or completely organic food such that we're totally pure even if other people are laboring and eating pesticides or any of the other ways that we try to dissociate from the kind of inevitable, I think, mess and muck of living in a world where things are really hard and anything we do causes pain to someone else, where we simultaneously wish that that was not so. So this little piece is coming from the part of the book that's thinking about the future and that's trying to ask what it looks like for us to create a future that we don't yet know, and we can't know what it's like because the world that we're in now is so fucked up, right? And yet, somehow, we work toward it, this world that we don't yet know. So the questions that we are asked to think about is are what movements have inspired us and what challenges we see. And so I'm mostly going to be talking about what inspires me and what I'm working through. And because this is sort of still work in progress, I'm mostly going to read. When I feel more settled with things, I just talk. So I hope that that's, I apologize for mostly reading. So what I've been interested in lately is, and appreciating, is thinking that gives us a kind of thick historical awareness of where we are, right? So the where, how has this world come to be the way it is, while giving us a kind of possibility or causally orienting us, making us be oriented toward collective struggle as a way out of the situation that we're in. And so one of the sort of anchors for me here is this concept of identifying into a kind of politics. And this is the second quote on that little sheet. So this comes out of work that I did when I was a grad student. I had the real honor of having as one of my supervisors, Angela Davis. And in the time that I worked with her, she repeated a bunch of times this idea that what we need is a mode of being, an identity politics, which she said grounded our identities in our politics rather than taking our politics from our identities. I'm just going to say that again because I think it's important and I've been struggling with it for a long time. Maybe you'll have ideas about how to think about it. So taking our identities from our politics rather than taking our politics from our identities. So I think that this is part of a kind of broader way of understanding and thinking about our deepest, most intimate subjectivity. So thinking about identity, what we are as contingent and situated, so situated in history, situated in relation, not essential, not pre-given, not natural. So I think that if we're going to take our identities from our politics, we need to create ways of being based in the specific political context we encounter and the political commitments that shape our response. So Davis frames this as identifying into, and this is the quote which I'll just read and then I'm gonna try to break it up and understand it. She says, "We are interested not in race and gender and class and sexuality and disability per se by themselves, but primarily as they have been acknowledged and as conditions for hierarchies of power, so that we can transform them into intertwined vectors of struggle for freedom." She's talking about the historical struggle around that we call feminism. She says, when we identify into feminism, we mean new epistemologies, new ways of producing knowledge, and transforming social relations. As scholars and activists, we realize that categories always fall short of the social realities they attempt to represent, and social realities always exceed the categories that attempt to contain them. That's why we keep changing our vocabularies. This is a very complicated quote, and I just want to sort of try to understand it together or explain it. So she's arguing that the important thing about social relations of oppression isn't that they have some inherent meaning that's always going to be there. We're not interested in social relations of oppression by themselves. We're interested in them because of what they manifest about conditions for hierarchies of power, fixed hierarchies of some people being higher and some people being lower. And that is important to us, not just because of that fixity, but because we're interested in struggling for multifaceted liberation. We want to transform the conditions for harmful hierarchies of power into what she calls intertwined vectors of struggle for freedom. So in this view, sites of oppression can be sites for liberation. But the social relations that determine what's oppression and what's liberation is going to be dynamic and shifting. So when we think about identity, we need to be able to also have those that dynamism and that kind of vector of freedom in our very being, our deepest, innermost being. So she's talking about this idea of identifying into feminism as an uneasy but usable political move. So the feminism we identify into can't be the same as identifying with already existing feminism, because already existing feminism is so messed up in so many ways, right? But we can identify into something in the sense of creating new ways of knowing, new epistemologies, new ways of producing knowledge, new ways of transforming social relations. So since these social realities exceed the things that we use to describe them, we can tune in to that thing that goes beyond. Is everyone doing okay with the speed that I'm talking with? And do you feel okay about that idea of identifying into? Does that feel like you kind of get it as an idea? So we leap towards something instead of finding something that already exists. So I've really been learning a lot about that idea from disability politics, critical disability politics. And I'm happy to talk a little bit more about my relation with disability in the discussion. I think one of the things that we know is that the category disabled is already so heterogeneous that it's really hard, and we don't want to say, this person is disabled, this person is not disabled. So we're not just looking when we think about disability as just something that we want a better set of diagnostic criteria that then we can like apportion state resources to help people who fall into it, right? That's not the idea. And also, when we're thinking about disability as a space that we could learn something from, we know that all of us are temporarily framed as able-bodied or as sane enough to get by, and that's well enough or good enough. That category is determined by capitalism and who's able to work for a wage, right? So we also know that in order for all of us to live on this earth, we are aligned with and help people who refuse or who can't be in those spaces. And my main example in a little bit is going to be about people on social assistance in Ontario and the question of how their experience shows us something about sexuality and disability in the mode of this kind of identifying into. So in order to sort of bring this over, I think that Davis is talking about identifying into feminism. I want to talk about identifying into disability practice. And I think that this means that everyone, however situated, can shape our life's practice in a way that contributes to self-determination and co-produced freedom. So this kind of identifying into brings theory, right, with a dynamic stretch to better account for and understand the social world, with practice, the in-the-moment enactment of life, right? What we're actually doing. So this is disability praxis. And I'm really thinking about this very practically, like how do we engage one another's minds and bodies? How do we move through public space? How do we talk together? How do we have sex? How do we plan events? But it's also theoretical, right? And it matters, I think, what view we take of the world that we're aiming toward. So I want to think about that idea of practice as the sign under which we talk about identifying into, because it matters what understanding we hold of the kind of beings that we are and the kind of world that this could be. Okay, so that's the identifying into part. The second section is about interdependence. So I think that coming again from critical disability movements, we know that decisions that seem to be just about personal morality and about individual purity are actually about the structures and conditions for livable lives, which lives are able to be lived. And in this world, interdependence has become a really key concept, particularly for those of us working on understanding disabilities from perspectives other than just thinking about impairment or about social processes. So the category of interdependence in this work names a permanently partial, co-produced world and subject with and through which relational connections are shaped. It names fundamental multiplicity, and it refuses political and ethical individualism. So in the longer version of what I'm talking about here, which I'm also happy to talk about more in conversation, the way that this gets framed is also through engaged Buddhist practitioners. And the title of my little remarks here comes from one named B, who says interconnectedness means fight. So if we understand ourselves as interdependent in this way, the view is, we're going to have to struggle to create a world in which we can all live. So a lot of the ways that we think about interdependence and disability theory is around understanding that other people, other beings cared for us when we were helpless and will in the future, but also that other beings grow our food, bring it to us, make it so that the lights can turn on, that at every piece of our life is reliant on other people's lives and energy, and that that's just the way that we are. We're relational to the ground. Like every fiber of our being relies on other beings. Even in the sense of like ecologies, right? That the grasses and the vegetables take up the sun's energy and make it into something that we can use. It's amazing. So thinking about interdependence, starting from there, helps us work from the understanding that our bodies and ourselves are complex co-productions of ourself, other people, and social relations. Okay, so I have about 4 more minutes of comment. And these last ones are going to be about queerness and queer desire. So queer desire means that we desire a world that isn't laid out for us. We're refusing the straight line, the line of descent that says, this is what you're supposed to be like, this is how you're supposed to want people, this is what you're supposed to do. Queerness deviates. It moves away from the assumed and the thing that we're supposed to want. And queerness in this sense is really useful for those of us that want to create a world that doesn't exist yet. Because those of us who have this experience know that it's possible to deviate from what's laid out for us and for that to be really fabulous and delicious. So queer desires for a new world are something that all of us can touch into, whether or not we identify as queer. So our current desires are shaped to the bone by oppressive social relations, right? The way that we want things and what we want is one of the places that most intimately and obviously we experience this, I think, my experience. And so if we think about the crushing hierarchies of power that come down on us in the place of our desire, we can really see, I think, what it looks like to transform crushing hierarchies of power, in Davis's words, into something that can be an intertwined vector of freedom. So I don't think that this can just be accomplished by people having more and better sex, although that's probably good too. But I want to just kind of get really concrete about this by thinking about a story about trauma and abuse. And I just want to flag that I'm going to be talking about child sexual abuse in not explicit ways, but I will be naming it and just trust you all to do whatever you need to do to take care of yourself in this space. So recently in Ottawa, about a year ago, where I live now, in Algonquin territory, there was a series of poverty town halls And someone that I was organizing with a little bit talked at these about being ritually abused as a kid by his parents and people in his community. And so one of the places that he talked about this, I'll call this person A, was in a meeting that was trying to oppose the cuts to the community startup benefit. I don't know if you have anything like this here in Nova Scotia, but in Ontario, the community startup benefit, which was cut last January, was something that if you were on OW, Ontario Works, or ODSP, Ontario Disability Support Program, you could apply for it. And if you were in a family, you could get $1,500 once every 3 years. And if you were single, you could get $798. And the purpose of the CUSB was to let you move into a new place if you were in an abusive relationship or if you had bed bugs, put a down payment on a thing, you know, an apartment. So they'd already cut the program. It used to be you could apply once every 12 months, then you could only apply once every 2 years. And now they've cut it completely and redistributed half of the money that was going to it to municipalities, to cities. So you can sort of see how if you're someone who's in an abusive situation or you're in an unlivable space, having this was really, really important if you're living in poverty. And A, who was talking about this, said, you know, without the community startup benefit, he was houseless at the time. He's like, I'm never going to be able to get an apartment in this rapidly gentrifying city. Ottawa's very expensive to live in. So I want to just mention also, and again, not knowing what it's like here, but there, ODSP, you get like a little bit more than $1,000 a month to live on, and 80% of that has to go toward rent. So it's ludicrous, ludicrous thing to try to live there on this. So I don't think it's totally clear right away how this is about sexuality and disability and about intertwined vectors of freedom. But consider this. Given how often people in ODSP have experienced sexual violation, fighting alongside them for more autonomy and better material support, I think expresses in the practice an intention to create more possibilities for healing, building resilience in the face of those histories, and preventing further sexual violence. So there's huge, lots of data about the way that people with disabilities, people living in poverty, have experienced a lot of violation, not just sexual, but all different kinds, such that when we try to claim a few more resources, we are actually creating conditions under which people can have access to better possibilities for freedom that we don't determine, right? That they determine. So sexuality here, around questions like, do you have a place to go where you can have sex if you're on disability? Can you put a down payment down on a room? Do you see how this is something that's about freedom? Okay, so I just want to close. So I see disability movements. I take inspiration from them. Disability movements that center work with people living in poverty as doing a form of queer desire as a kind of prefigurative practice, living the world we yearn for in the present that denies it and pulling that world into being. So the last little quote on that sheet that you have comes from Barbara Epstein, who says, there's always a prefigurative element in radical politics. So that's living the world we want in the current world that we actually are in, or at least a pull toward prefigurative politics. Because without an effort to live one's values, radical claims collapse into hypocrisy. There's also a pull to accommodate to the existing structure so as to be able to operate effectively in it. So that means saying, don't cut community startup benefit. Don't do it. You know, that's within the existing structure. She says, each movement finds its own balance between these opposing forces. So when we understand ourselves as interdependent in a deep way, we might be called or turn ourselves toward identifying into disability practice. A key piece of such practice will be a materially situated, politically radical analysis of how oppressions interlock, an understanding of how ritual abuse of children connects with poverty and cuts to programs that allow people on Ontario Works or ODSP to have better access to minimal standards for dignified lives. Queer disability struggles, resting on a profound view of the situated, partial, and in-process nature of ourselves and their expression in complex bodies and desires, can shape and change this world. And I desperately want us to pursue that transformation. Thanks.